Hi, it's Diane. Great to be back with you for our Tuesday podcast. On my mind, are we in the midst of a constitutional crisis? Top Democrats seem to think so. Last week, Nancy Pelosi used the term to describe the Trump administration's defiance of congressional investigations. Meanwhile, the president has predictably mocked the idea, calling it a new Democratic talking point. To help understand this stalemate and its consequences, I invited Norman Ornstein to join me in the studio. He is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and a contributor to both the Atlantic Magazine and the National Journal. Norm Ornstein, great to have you here.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Diane.
Tell me what this term, constitutional crisis, means that Democrats are tossing around.
Well, I view this as a constitutional crisis in this sense. The fundamentals of the Constitution, the separation of powers, the fact that Congress is the first branch. There are three branches that are in some ways equal, but I used to take my students to the National Archives, where they have the original Constitution, one of the copies remaining, on four pages. And visually, when you see it, the first two pages, practically, of the four are Article 1. Article 2 is half that length. Article 3 on the judiciary is half again what that is. And it's not simply a coincidence that Congress was given the ultimate powers. Congress can remove a president through impeachment. He can't remove members of Congress. Congress can veto his bills or can pass bills that he can veto, but they can override his veto. We have all of those things. And what Trump is doing now is challenging those fundamentals. And the Republicans in the Senate who have a majority are going along with him. So that's the first part of the crisis that I think we have. The second part is the basics of the rule of law. And there the judiciary comes into play. And then the third part is the norms that undergird all of the precepts of the Constitution and the laws themselves. Things don't work if the norms get broken. Mitch McConnell, I believe, broke fundamentally the norms of the Senate, and Donald Trump has broken even more the norms of governance.
So what does the Constitution say about Congress's right to investigate the executive?
Congress is given explicitly the power to pass laws and to see that the laws are faithfully executed. And the president takes an oath to see that the laws are faithfully executed. And if, in fact, we have a president who isn't doing that, and Congress is not given the information that it rightfully gets or should get, then to me, we're pushing close to a crisis. Now, you know, you can step back with a caveat, which is every president has disputes with Congress over powers. This is not a clean separation of powers. It's a struggle over who's going to prevail. And, you know, politics enters into it. Presidents use executive privilege, which is not explicitly in the Constitution, but it's clearly there. The executive has some independence. And Congress sometimes will dispute that. Congress can overreach. There's no question. With its investigations, or it can do things for political spite. But every time in the past, there's been a fundamental respect for the boundaries here. There is no respect for the boundaries.
How does the president prevent the special counsel, Mueller, from testifying before Congress?
I think we're going to see Mueller testifying.
You do.
We're done. Yeah. And, you know, I think Mueller is a private person.
Yes,
of course. But, you know, he is somebody who goes very relentlessly by the book, which is why in his report he did not recommend indictment of the president. But there are a couple of things that are clear in that report. One is that he laid out all of the grounds, and in 12 instances in that report, he said there was substantial evidence of crimes being committed. And then the last sentence was basically taken from the Nixon impeachment case. And it becomes clear when you look at the totality of the report and the end that his expectation was that if you don't indict a president because of the Office of Legal Counsel ruling, not because the Constitution says you can't indict a president, that we're not going to indict a sitting president. It's then up to Congress to act with impeachment. Mueller, I think, wants to leave it at that and leave it up to Congress to deal with. But in the end, the president can't keep him from testifying, and he can't refuse to testify if in the end a frustrated Congress decides to subpoena him. And of course, we're having that struggle now with Donald Trump Jr.
Well, what about Don McGahn?
So same thing. McGahn can himself say, I'm not going to testify. Congress can subpoena him. The president cannot prevent a former employee from testifying.
Are you sure of that?
Well, it'll go to the courts. And God knows what these judges will do. And we know that Trump has now filled a sixth of the appeals court judges in the country. It is a Trump Supreme Court. We don't know how far they'll go to protect him. And we don't know what kind of intimidation there will be for some of these witnesses.
Okay. Suppose the special counsel, Mueller, says, I will testify. And then the president says, he may not testify. Would that then go to the court?
So assuming that Mueller has cut his ties with the Justice Department, Trump, I would believe, could try and file an injunction to keep him from testifying. But I cannot see for the life of me any grounds in which he can prevent somebody from who is a former employee from testifying. Now, you can lay out some areas where the testimony should not be permissible. If there are, for example, significant grounds for executive privilege. In the case of Don McGahn, where he's testifying about his conversations with the president as the lawyer in the White House, there could be grounds, except that because this has already been discussed with the independent counsel and is reflected in the report, executive privilege is waived. So you really are on shaky ground based on every precedent I've seen to say, no, you cannot testify.
So let's get to the politics then. There are a growing number of, or an increasing number of Democrats who want to see impeachment go forward. Nancy Pelosi has said, let's just go through the investigative process. What's your thinking?
So before Pelosi took that approach, I actually wrote a piece in The Atlantic in which I said the best way to handle this, because most Americans not only haven't read the Mueller report, but really don't have a full sense of what's there. And William Barr, the attorney general, tried to frame it for people who wouldn't have a look at it as exoneration for the president. I think it was an outrageous thing, set of things that Barr did, but a whole lot of people believe that. And that's not just those who are true believers in Trump to begin with. You want to have the ability to lay out for a broader public a case for why you're moving forward to impeachment. You would hope that you could do that in an intensive way across several committees in a month or two and then decide where you go from there. But frankly, Trump himself is precipitating action, both by the delay process, so you can't bring in people to testify to get that full picture of the report, and by taking a set of actions that are like a thumb in the eye to Congress, daring them to move forward. Now, you know, you could envision reasons why he might be doing that in a Machiavellian way, that his hope for reelection is in so inciting his base that they turn out in large numbers because he's the victim here. Or it might be just what Roy Cohn and his father taught him, which is somebody begins to go after you, you hit back at them doubly hard. But I think if we continue in this path of stonewalling, it may be that Congress has to open up an impeachment inquiry to have the leverage in the courts and more generally to get people to come in so that they can get that evidence. And that's, you know, it's tricky business. You want to be careful that you don't have this blow up.
And now a quick break. When we come back, more from Norm Ornstein.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District,
Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here is the rest of my conversation with Norm Ornstein, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. His latest book is titled One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. Do you agree with Nancy Pelosi when she says the president is trying to goad Democrats into going for impeachment?
So it gets back to whether this is a Machiavellian move on
his
part or not. I wouldn't say necessarily trying to goad, but he's goading. He's doing it in a fashion that may force their hand. And they're going to have to be careful a little bit about how they handle it. And I think it's going to take at least a little bit more to make a case to independents, suburban voters, and a broader electorate that they're not taking this step lightly, and it's not just for political retribution.
But isn't
ideally, you get a couple of people like Mueller and McGahn testifying in a way that does make it clear that it's important to do so.
But isn't that precisely what Chairman Nadler is trying to do?
Yes.
He's trying to move the process forward by bringing forth witnesses, but there is the president, the White House, trying to forestall those witnesses.
No, that's absolutely the case. Now, you know, there could be another path to go, but it would require some help from the broader media. Okay. One of the things that I've suggested, Ben Wittes, who's at Brookings and has this Lawfare blog, has done a couple of pieces where he has gone through the Mueller report and come up with conclusions that are done by a very careful legal analyst that really do make the case that Trump has committed impeachable acts over and over and over again. You could bring in somebody like Wittes and go through this systematically in a public way that makes clear what the Mueller report contains. But if it's not covered by television, then it's going to be subsumed by other events during the course of the day or the week. So that's where Nadler, if he can't get some of this cooperation, it may have to open up a formal impeachment inquiry. Because believe me, if it is impeachment, then the networks are going to say, oh, we got to cover this.
But are you saying that if someone like Ben Wittes were to testify that CNN or MSNBC would simply ignore it?
They wouldn't cover it live, gavel to gavel, put it that way.
And that's what you believe it needs.
So I'm old enough to go back to being very much directly immersed in the Nixon impeachment process. The Watergate Committee in the Senate with Howard Baker, Sam Ervin et al. Was covered
gavel to gavel.
The House Judiciary Committee hearings were covered gavel to gavel. Those things, starting with the Senate, brought a substantial share of a public that was resistant to believing that Richard Nixon should be impeached to a different place. It took a while. But if you had not had those kinds of hearings, and if you could argue if we had social media the tribal media back then, it might have been a different outcome. You have to have a process where a broader public, not just partisans, say, wow, this is not the way it's supposed to work.
At the same time, you've got the president saying fake news, fake media, everybody except Fox News, yeah. Fake media. So wouldn't he simply counter all that?
Well, of course he would and he will. And here I would emphasize something that is critically important. And again, go back to Nixon. You had Howard Baker, an honest person, one of the great heroes of public service of the 20th century. Now, when he asked that famous question, what did the president know and when did he know it? I think he probably felt confident that the answer would be it wasn't him, it was his underlings. But he took it to its logical conclusion. Hugh Scott was the Republican leader in the Senate. He insisted on an honest and open and fair-minded process. John Rhodes was the Republican leader in the House, fierce partisan, did the same thing. The House Judiciary Committee, people like Tom Railsback, M. Caldwell Butler, William Cohen, Republicans who looked at the evidence and said, yes, this president has committed impeachable offenses. None of them have parallels now. Not a one.
Exactly.
And when you have Lindsey Graham, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, openly defying his own Republican chair of the Intelligence Committee and the law, and urging Donald Trump Jr. to ignore a subpoena from the Senate Intelligence Committee, what it tells you is that we don't have an honest process. But that makes it even more important that you can reach at least that part of the public that isn't going to be with Trump, even if he killed somebody in broad daylight on Fifth Avenue.
Norm, you sort of take my breath away. I, too, am old enough to remember and to have watched those hearings. You had a group of honest brokers on all sides. Here, you have Mitch McConnell standing up and saying, case closed. He's not going to have anything more to do with anything investigating President Trump. So how does that leadership bring forth the kind of conscientious, real thinking from his fellow members of Congress?
I have been shocked and dismayed, not so much at McConnell. He can't shock me anymore because this is a longstanding set of behaviors, and I believe he will go down in history as one of the great villains undermining our fundamental system. But, you know, we have a press corps that keeps referring to this struggle as Congress versus the president. If it were, I would feel better about it. Because if you had the Senate and the House standing up for their own prerogatives and for the constitutional system, Trump would be forced to compromise. If the Senate said, if you stonewall and won't allow people to testify when it's clear we have the ability and the need to bring them in, you won't get a single judge confirmed. You won't have a single member of your executive branch confirmed. He would change. If they had the joint ability to use the appropriations process to squeeze him on the wall, on immigration, on issues he cares about, he would compromise. But it's the House Democrats against the Republicans in the Senate and the president. And it's like a wrestling tag team where they've got two and you've got one, and one can hold you with your arms behind your back while the other one pummels you. And that is the most shocking element of this. Lindsey Graham said famously during the campaign and afterward, there comes a time when you have to put country over party. He has not once put country over party. And if there's a motto for Republicans in Congress right now, it is party over country. That makes Trump not quite immune from the consequences of his actions, but in a far stronger position than he should be, given everything that he has done and that is on the record.
And in the same breath, you have to look at what's happening internationally. On the midst or on the edge of a trade war with China, on the edge of an invasion of Venezuela, and on the edge of some kind of action against Iran. Where is this country going if you shift the public's attention to foreign interventions while all of this is happening here?
Well, I do believe that the international system is in disarray, as a significant part of it is because of the policies that Trump has followed. And if there's one person gleeful about all of this, it's Vladimir Putin. Our alliances are in tatters. The president basically shuns people like Macron and Merkel and then pals around with Viktor Orban, who is an anti-Semitic autocrat who has cracked down on the press, on education, on the judiciary, all of the classic things that autocrats do. And we know that the American ambassador to Hungary, who's known Trump for 25 years, told Frank Foer, you know, I know the president. He would love to be able to do what Orban has done, or some equivalent of that. So we've got all of that.
And what does that mean? I'd love to be able
it
to
means,
do.
It means Trump admires strongmen.
Dictators.
Trump, from his entire career, it's been, you do this or else. And that's not the nature of the American political system. You know, you remember the famous line of Harry Truman when he was about to leave the White House and Dwight Eisenhower, who had been this incredible general, was coming in. And Truman said, poor Ike, he's used to telling people do this, do that, and having orders carried out. And he's going to be very disappointed when he sits in this chair. It's a different kind of operation. At the same time, there's an amorality here. Going to war as a distraction is something that most presidents wouldn't consider. I don't think it would cause Trump one moment of delay if that were something that he thought could serve his interests.
But what about the generals? How would they react?
Some are going to resist, but not all of them. And, you know, here's another example, not just the generals. We've had an acting Secretary of Defense for several months now, another area where the law has basically been stretched to the limit and then broken, the Vacancies Act. And once he proved his loyalty, he gets nominated for the position. How does he prove his loyalty? By saying, you know what, we'll send a bunch of troops to the border and we'll relax the restrictions on what they can do inside the border of the United States. That is shocking. But if that's the case, we're going to find some people in the military who will go along with what he orders. He's still the commander in chief. One of the unfortunate realities of this, Diane, is much of the law and many of the norms that we have in our governance have been built, especially in the post-Cold War era, around the idea that we have a president who is a rational person who puts the interests of the country first. And so we've given that president powers based on those assumptions that he will have good advisors who will give him the best advice too. So a president can order the use of nuclear weapons and nobody can stop him from that.
Nobody.
Now, you know, you can have the military commanders who then have to carry out the action saying, no, I won't do that. and then they'll be relieved of their command, and he'll keep going down until he'll find somebody who can. There are all kinds of things that presidents can do, and presidents have pushed the boundaries of executive power out of frustration with tribal politics in Congress. But this is a different matter. And I do believe, not just because it would be a distraction, but because the people around him see military force as one of the first steps rather than one of the last steps, that quite possibly out of frustration with what's happening in Venezuela. And remember that we now have a bunch of Republicans in Florida, according to the Washington Post, who have been urging the president to take out Maduro, because if not, the Venezuelan emigres won't vote Republican in 2020. We know that once Trump decided to blow up the Iran nuclear deal, that we were going to head towards a confrontation. At some point, Iran was going to say, all right, you've unilaterally pulled out of this deal. We're not going to abide by every element of it. And we have at least some reports as well suggesting that the Iranian government, because the sanctions have hurt them in economic terms, they're not quite as strong as they were, might not be unhappy with at least some kind of confrontation with the United States that would strengthen their hand. So lots of things can happen. And we got North Korea sitting out there continuing to do provocative acts.
Right.
That could be very, very dangerous. And a war with Iran would be far more costly than the war we had with Iraq.
In the meantime, Trump's popularity has remained right where it was.
So we have to look back at another reality here, which is our politics have gone beyond partisanship and ideological polarization into tribalism. And this is as much about tribal identity as anything else. And it's not even you can have all kinds of people who support Trump. There are many who support Trump who believe that God sent him to save America. There are others who are motivated by darker reasons. There are some who will say, yeah, he's a pig. Yeah, he's a thief. Yeah, he's an awful person in many ways, but he's ours. And if they prevail, those people who are trying to destroy our way of life will win. And so I don't think there is much of anything that will take him well below 40% unless it were a depression.
Well, as you and I are talking on Tuesday morning, we have yesterday a 600-plus point drop in the stock market, of which Trump has been very proud in the past. Where is this confrontation with China going?
One element of this, his fundamental understanding of trade economics is lacking.
Zilch.
The notion that the tariffs are money China is giving to the United States and it's all a plus for us when it's fundamentally a tax on consumers.
Of course.
But of course, he's taking that and then turning around and trying to give enormous subsidies to farmers who are the ones hurt the most by all of this, which is pretty much a working definition of socialism in some ways. But that aside, farmers are being devastated. They're losing markets to others. And once you've lost a market, even if the trade war ends, you may not get it back. Will those farmers turn against him? At the same time, when you get into this retaliatory set of actions, $200 billion in tariffs imposed by the United States, $60 billion by China on the other side, you're going to have some impact on the global economy. And what we also know is the tax cuts that were the most significant piece of legislation passed in the Trump administration were, in my judgment, the most reckless set of fiscal actions taken in American history. But even more significant for the long run is when you do what we could call a pro-cyclical policy, when you have a hyper-stimulus, when you're at full employment and the economy is growing, it's like a sugar high. It's an artificial stimulant, and it ends badly. When, we don't know. And when it ends, when we have a downturn, because of those tax cuts, we've taken away the weapons that you should have to get the economy moving again. You can't cut taxes when you have deficits and debt that are growing dramatically. You can't increase spending when you most need to without having a serious deleterious effect otherwise. There's no real ability to act with monetary policy. So the next downturn is likely to be a really bad one, but we don't know if it's going to happen before the 2020 election or not. And even with that, my guess is Trump gets 35%, and we have to keep in mind that the nature of the Electoral College and the distribution of people across states is such that the next time Trump could lose the popular vote if he's still president and running for re-election by 8 or 9 million and could still conceivably win the Electoral College.
Because the Electoral College is still in business.
And tilted towards smaller, more rural states. You know, by 2040, 50% of Americans will live in 8 states and 70% will live in 15 states. And that is, you know, terrible for the Senate. 30% of Americans will elect 70 senators. But it also means that the Electoral College is going to grow even more distorted. When it was created, and it was, you know, a cold compromise to try and keep the states together, the ratio of population between the smallest and largest states when they were first considering this was about 12 to 1. Now it's 70 to 1, and that's only going to grow. And that means that the leverage of voters in places like Wyoming and Alaska is several times more than for voters in California or Florida or New York. And that's a distortion. And we're going to have increasing instances where the winner of the popular vote loses the presidency. That's a crisis of legitimization that goes beyond Trump. But it also means that Trump has an advantage, even if his support stays where it is or erodes a little bit.
Mornstein, as always, thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
And that's all for today. I'd love to hear your feedback. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. You can find all our podcasts and even old Diane Rehm shows at dianerehm.org. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Cliff Gallagher and Natalie Yurev-Lipker. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you on Friday. I'm Diane Rehm.